very much.
That disposes of the remaining items on our morning agenda. Thanks for your patience, everybody. We will now move to our afternoon agenda, item number 772.
Adopt requirements for deconstruction of the city's oldest and most historic houses and duplexes.
Well, I'm very pleased to have this item before us, following up on the resolution that the council passed some months ago. What deconstruction does is remove materials safely from a place where they have sat for a long time in their first use or original use in a Portland house. Doing it this way creates jobs, several jobs created versus the number that would be typical in mechanized demolition. We're taking an approach that prioritizes women and people of color to train to do this work. It obviously has a significant effect on taking materials to the landfill versus reusing them. It's making real part of our commitment in our climate action plan. It's viewing older houses as assets, which I think is a good point of view for us to have. And it's part of a broader effort to discourage demolition. And I think this will have that effect. This will apply the requirements, as you'll hear from Susan and Sean, to houses over 100 years old, as you may have noticed in my discussions about this issue, and they certainly have. I've been pacing the floor hoping we could do more than the first third of houses in the original effort here at the city, but I've been persuaded that it's smart to walk before you run. And so this approach has us taking on about a third of the typical flow of demolition that we see in the course of a year, focusing on the oldest houses first, and then the council will have the chance, as you'll hear, to revisit how we're doing and whether we can now do more at some point not too far in the future. So again, I want to thank our Bureau for doing great work and making this proposal real and bringing it here today, and I'll turn it over to Susan Anderson and Sean Wood to take it from there. Thank you.
Right. Good afternoon, Mayor, Council. Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and Sean Wood with our Green Building Program. As the Mayor mentioned, in February, you all approved a resolution and directed us to look at opportunities to promote deconstruction when, of course, a home has already been decided to tear it down. So today we are here to review the specific code language and to hear public testimony. This code language will make Portland the first city in the United States to require deconstruction.
Can I just note that according to this slide, you're already deconstructing the park we just built?
It happens.
Yeah. There we go.
We're all planners. Right.
There we go. We're planning ahead. So this ordinance here will actually make Portland the first U.S. city to require deconstruction. Several other cities around the country are looking to us. They're hoping we will move swiftly so that they can copy us. So I really appreciate your leadership on this. In the comprehensive plan, which you remember, that you all adopted just a few weeks ago, you provided policy direction for many, many things. And among those things was direction to encourage the salvage and reuse of building materials. It was included because of the significant human health issues, economic benefits, and carbon reduction benefits. So as promised, when we adopted that plan, we're trying to turn those policies into action quickly. So we're here to talk about this ordinance today. And Sean will review the ordinance and the details. Thanks.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. Again, I'm Sean Wood with Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And just a little bit of background on how we got here today. It was basically a year and a half ago, the council had asked the Bureau to develop an advisory group to look at ways of incentivizing and advancing deconstruction activity within the city. We established a deconstruction advisory group last April, and we've met a total of 16 times since then. Late August, early September, we kicked off a deconstruction grant program with initial seed funding of $50,000 from our solid waste management fund reserves, and have since received an additional $50,000 from DEQ to supplement that grant program. And then more recently in February, we were here with a resolution on deconstruction that council unanimously supported, and there were three major components to that resolution, and that'll basically provide the outline for staff's presentation today. The first was to develop code language that would require deconstruction for houses and duplexes that are seeking a demolition permit, and we would require deconstruction if those houses were built in 1916 or earlier, or designated as a historic resource regardless of age. So that helps salvage materials from our oldest and most historic buildings. The second component to the resolution was about training and certification. In that particular resolution said, we need to ensure that we have adequate training and certification opportunities and place a priority on women, people of color, and other disadvantaged groups or underrepresented groups in the field of construction. And then the third major component I call course correction. So it was taking a look at what we do if for some reason there's unforeseen market or labor conditions out in the field that would make it difficult to keep the resolution or keep the ordinance moving forward. And as Mayor Hells mentioned, we are talking about 1916 for a reason. It is tempting to go farther and put other types of buildings or newer buildings into this requirement. But our advisory group very distinctly landed on 1916 for the reasons that it does represent a third of all demos, and that's a reasonable first step so that we can take this first step, succeed, and then move forward with bringing in other building types or other year-built categories. So in terms of code development, we worked closely with the Bureau of Development Services, our deconstruction advisory group, the city attorney, and then also sought feedback on draft code language from the public during a four-week public comment period. During that time, staff met with four different neighborhood coalitions, gave briefings at the Historic Landmarks Commission, the Design Commission, the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and then also BDS's Development Review Advisory Committee, or DRAC. And kind of in summary for the code language itself, the nuts and bolts of it are we're relying on the work from certified deconstruction contractors to do the work covered under this new requirement. And that ensures a level of quality of understanding of what we're talking about. Doesn't just let anyone come in and say, oh, we're going to deconstruct this, and then it turns out it's demolished in the end. These are going to be folks that have gone through a training and for sure a certification component in order to work on these projects. We'll also have both pre- and post-deconstruction forms to help identify what materials will be salvaged, and then also report on what materials weren't salvaged and reasons why. And that'll be accompanied with documentation like receipts for donation or sale of materials, and those mirror requirements that we actually have in our deconstruction grant program, so it's not totally new. And then a big part of code language is enforcement. It's kind of easy to say what we want. It's the harder part to ensure that you actually get it. So there's a relatively healthy amount of information in the code on enforcement. Site posting is one of the things we'll do to ensure that things are happening out in the field that we want to. So it'll identify a site as being deconstructed. So if we see neighbors that have concerns about heavy machinery on site and damaging what could otherwise be usable materials, we can go out and respond to that. BPS will conduct random inspections. We do have the ability to leverage penalties and fines. And then something unique, I think, to this code language is since we are requiring certified deconstruction contractors, we have the ability to suspend their certification. So if they're found in noncompliance with the requirements, there's an incentive for them to stay on top of their game and not get taken off that list. Training and certification is the other major part of the resolution. We worked closely with a consultant that BPS hired, Work Systems Inc., which you'll hear from here in a little bit, and also worked with a diverse stakeholder committee to come up with a training and certification plan. And we've chosen the Building Material Reuse Association curriculum and then also their master trainers to play a big role in not only training and certifying contractors but also workforce development training. For the training of contractors, we'll have a pool of both existing deconstruction contractors, demolition contractors, and then a really strong showing from folks that are our contractors in our prime development contractor program. And those are all MWESB certified firms, and they'll actually make up a large component of the deconstruction contractors that will be involved with this.
Can you hold this slide for a second?
Yes.
I'm going to have a series of questions later on capacity, but the current date is October 2016?
Correct. For effective date.
How many certified firms are there today?
Zero.
So how do we expect in the next few months to have a requisite number of firms with 500 hours of experience?
So they can report those hours retroactively, so they can point to past experience. The Building Material Reuse Association, or the BMRA, for their credential requires 2,000 hours of experience. We had a conversation in our advisory group that to have 2,000 hours would be a barrier to folks that are new entrants into this field.
And I'm a big believer in taking numbers that don't mean anything and anchoring them to something that does. So how many projects would you actually work on in order to get 500 hours of experience?
If you had zero going in, so a lot. We chose 500 because if you have experience in construction, so not even necessarily in deconstruction, but if you have experience in construction, it should be relatively easy to get to document 500 hours from past experience. So the folks that will be entering this the certification are going to be contractors already. They're going to have their CCB license. They're not going to be bakers that are suddenly entering the deconstruction field.
How many houses were there?
Give you a concrete example. Mayor Hales decides to sell his house, and they're going to deconstruct it. How many hours would I get towards my credit for deconstructing his house?
So it's a little difficult to answer your question because there's a number of different categories of core competencies.
Give me the most oversimplified answer you can think of.
I would say maybe three houses.
Three houses.
For
500
hours.
Right.
It's a number that doesn't mean anything unless it's linked to the experience. So roughly,
right.
If you did roughly three houses, you might qualify under the 500 hours.
Right, but at the same time, there's core competencies that you would have to have experience in order to get that 500 hours. And a lot of those are things like site preparation and safety aspects that cross the line between whether it's new construction or deconstruction or demolition. So the BMRA actually calls this certification deconstruction for demo contractors. So it provides a pathway for those that are in the field of removing houses to get this type of certification. So Commissioner Fish, you asked how many are certified today. So it's zero. So we just set a date for our training time and then also location for the certified deconstruction contractor training, and that'll be held July 18th at a city-owned house that's been identified to come down. We just opened up registration for that yesterday. Based on our existing deconstruction contractor workforce, as well as folks from the Prime Contractor Development Program, we're looking at least probably 12 or 15 different companies getting certified after the week of July 18th.
So if you have 12 or 15 companies that are certified, the next question someone might ask is, if you follow historical patterns, how many houses might be subject to this in year one? If the market doesn't change.
If the market doesn't change, it'll be about 100 houses would fall under this requirement. Now, that doesn't mean that other houses can't be deconstructed, it's just they wouldn't be required to. So as far as what would be under this requirement, it would be 100 houses, or roughly a third of all demolitions, house and duplex
There's
demolitions.
There's a fair amount of unrequired deconstruction already going on in the city.
That's right. Right, so there's full house, there's also partial, you know, related to remodels, kitchen deconstruction, stuff like that. And then the second component of the training, which is can't be understated, is the workforce development. So it's great we'll have contractors identified after the week of July 18th, and we can use that to right-size how much workforce we actually need out there. So part of that is determined by how many contractors are in the field, how many folks from their existing workforce they'll use on these new projects. So we can right-size that afterwards. Right now we're estimating around 20 folks that would need to be trained as part of this. Kelly Haynes from Work Systems, Inc. will describe a little bit more about how the benefits of going through this training role translate into on-the-job training benefits, and then also benefits for the contractors that hire the folks that that come out of this training. And then the third component to the resolution was, again, what I call course correction. So there's been concerns expressed that we may not have enough workforce available when it comes time October 31st. What if the market is not there for this material? How do we hit the pause button? We've heard those concerns in our advisory group. During the four-week public comment period, we also heard kind of the flip side of that coin. How do we move faster? How do we get 1920s houses? How do we get 1960s, 1970s houses in here? What if this is doing really well and we want to advance this as quickly as possible? So what we ended up doing was coming back to City Council at both 6 months and 12 months after the effective date to report on the status. And at that time, we can look at either modifying, maintaining, or expanding the program. We also went a step further and added, under the authority of the director, to suspend the requirements. So if there are market conditions or labor conditions that warrant that, we've added that. Both of those things, I think, are somewhat, especially in terms of the code, are kind of unprecedented. We don't usually set up the pause here button in code, but there was enough concern, I think, that we are, as Susan mentioned, this is the first city to do this. So we're trailblazers, and we're doing our best to make sure this is successful coming out of the gate. But there are going to be folks that have concerns, and this is one of the ways to address that.
Can I just ask about the suspension power for a minute? This would include suspending because there just isn't the workforce or number of contractors available to do the work that's coming in, right?
Right.
Do you have any preliminary ideas about what the circumstances would be in which you would decide that it's appropriate to invoke suspension? Like, would you have to get calls saying, we're not going to get anybody to do the work for 6 months, or we can't get anybody to do the work for 3 months, or we can't get anybody to do the work right now?
Right. So we stopped shy of setting actual thresholds, but our advisory group will continue to meet certainly between now and October and then after October, so we can keep a pulse on this. And certainly one of the most concrete items that's pointed to is, what happens if it takes me 3 months to get somebody out on site? We talked about having, an actual number in there. Like, if wait time ends up being a certain amount of time, the caveat is there could be another side to that argument. So it could be that a contractor is waiting till the 11th hour to call up a deconstruction contractor. I think they'll have to be a little bit of adaptation on both the deconstruction contractors, but also the builders when it comes to this. So, it's probably not advisable to call up a deconstruction contractor the week you need a house taken down. And that'll just be part of, I think, the learning curve with all of this. But we'll rely on our advisory group for sure to see, is this something that really does warrant suspension, like we need to do this right now, or is there some kind of log jam that we can work with the industry to correct and move forward? And then we've also established a...
You skipped your wonderful slide about the firms, I think.
Oh, yeah. I'll get to that next.
Okay, sorry.
I just want to get to the goals. So we also have a goal in the ordinance so that we can have a clear pathway forward to try and get other houses covered under this ordinance. And so it's a goal of including houses that were built before 1941 or year built 1940 or earlier by the year 2019. We considered codifying that and actually having a series of steps where we would say, okay, after year 2017, we'll go to 1925. Kind of the consensus with our advisory group was, let's have clear, defined goals, but stop short of codifying that. That allows us to look at a number of things as we look at taking future steps and look at things like the market and the capacity, and then make the right step forward. And this is the slide I'll finish with. I mean, one of the things that we're really fortunate to have here in Portland is a really robust both demand for the salvage material and an industry to support it. So these are all existing companies, and you know, 6 months from the effective date and a year from the effective date, we'll want to come back to this and look how this landscape has changed. But this is kind of a pretty broad overview of the Portland area salvage industry ecosystem, everything from the folks that are taking down the buildings to supplying to retails, nonprofits, to the folks that are actually working with this material, the makers, and then the supporters. So folks like the Building Material Reuse Association, certainly our bureau, Department of Environmental Quality, are all supporting this effort. DEQ is interested in financing part of the workforce training, so they see this as an important potential model for other jurisdictions in the state to see succeed. So it's definitely, there are a lot of eyes watching us, and we have a step forward. When I've been in discussions with folks in Vancouver, BC, they don't, if we did a slide like this for their industry, it wouldn't look nearly as robust. And so it's a harder lift for other jurisdictions to do something like we're considering today, because they would also have to build this infrastructure and demand. We're fortunate enough to have this already in place and be poised to see it expand. I mean, the Habitats Restore is opening up a new store here in the next year. There's things you don't see on this slide, which are relationships between these different companies to help move supply of materials and partnerships. So we look forward to seeing that expand in the future.
I was really impressed by this when Sean showed me this graphic, just that, you know, this isn't theoretical.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of capacity already there, and it just seems like, you know, Portland's in a pretty good place to be the leader on this, since we already have people who know how to do this, who have the skills, who are doing this business already, and we have a very strong interest in preserving houses that can be preserved, or at the very least preserving the pieces of those houses that can be reused. So the combination of policy interest and actual competency really gives us some strength here that not any other city probably at this point would have.
And I think when we come back with our 6 month or 12 month check-in, we'll have job numbers for you a little bit, because I think it would be good to really look at how many jobs are actually related to the whole salvage industry, because it's probably more than we think.
I have a few questions, Mayor.
Please.
You know, there's been, we've received a couple of emails, people just asking questions, and then, of course, there's been some commentary. So I think it'd be helpful just to address some of those questions up front, and then we'll take testimony. The task force, what was the ultimate, was there a vote of the task force? Was there a majority opinion? Was there a minority view? How did it end up shake out?
So timing would have been back in December. I don't know if I'd characterize it as a vote, but we kind of polled our advisory group and said, okay, how about a requirement looking at 100 years old or older, and looking at that line, I think the discussion was probably more important about where that line is drawn. And so, you know, is it 5% of demos, 10%? Ultimately, we looked at a third of demos. And that was a consensus amongst the group that would be a reasonable first step
forward
with.
In general, since you had a task force, did you reach consensus on the recommendation that's coming before us?
Correct. Yes. The resolution that was brought in February. And then we worked with our advisory group to draft the code language and get their input on the code language today.
I forgot the answer to this question from the last time it came before council, and we unanimously said, yes, let's move forward. What's the difference in cost between the sort of historical way that houses are demolished and deconstruction?
So it'll range, but let's say a 2,500 square foot house would cost $10,000 to demolish. The same size house might cost $17,000 to deconstruct.
Okay, and is that price, if it turns out that we don't see as many certified contractors in the marketplace as quickly as we would like, is it likely that that'll put upward pressure on the cost, since there's fewer people competing for more work?
It would, and that's exactly why we've tried to figure out a way to inject the industry with additional players, because right now there are only a few, and so when you don't have competition, you don't have innovation, and so that's one of the things that we're trying to solve for here.
And I guess that leads to the biggest anxiety that we've detected out there, which is you've built in a course correction mechanism. But we're hearing from some people that would like you to do a course correction now and not wait. And in a sense, in effect, they're saying that, you know, it's laudable to move this as quickly as possible, but unrealistic in 3 months to have enough firms certified, enough workers trained, and a system up and running. And so why not put that date out a little bit further so that we have more confidence that the system is ready to accommodate the demand?
And I'd be the first person to hop on board with that if I thought that was the case. But, you know, working closely with our advisory group and the folks that are in this industry now, the folks that are poised to enter the industry, I'm confident that we'll have all of that ready by October 31st.
So, Susan, would you entertain a friendly amendment on this in addition to the six-month report at the back end if we asked you to let us know in writing a week or 2 weeks before the effective date that you believe that we have the capacity?
Sure.
Because the council can always push that date back if it chooses. But you're making a reasonable projection that you're going to have in 3 months this set up. There's some people that are anxious about that. We don't want this system to fail. We don't want people to be backlogged and to be dealing with unreasonable costs, maybe even cost gouging, if the market isn't mature enough. It seems to me, Mayor, if Susan came back to us a couple of weeks before that effective date, and gave us an update and put her best foot forward on that, that would give the council a chance to revisit that date if we thought it was still too aggressive.
Sure, I like that idea. Comfortable with that, Susan?
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions, suggestions?
I have one more thing that was raised in testimony from the home builders, and that was the suggestion that could a certified deconstructionist certify that this house is a piece of rubbish and has nothing in it worth saving?
Right. So we do have an exemption provision for both unsafe buildings and as well as ones that, to put it frankly, like really aren't worth deconstructing. And there are some that will say, all houses are worth deconstructing just because of the limited dust and hazmat exposure. But in our advisory group, for the most part, we agreed that, yeah, there really are some houses that shouldn't be deconstructed. We've purposely left the code vague on exactly what would fall under that exemption. We'll handle that under the administrative rules for procedures. But that's certainly one of the things we've talked about is having some sort of letter from a certified deconstruction contractor. The tricky part ends up becoming, is there a conflict of interest there with the certified deconstruction contract? It's like an arborist. Is this tree, should this tree come down?
Well, except that they point out that the deconstructionist is in the business of wanting to deconstruct.
Right.
So that it is actually the opposite of the arborist.
Right.
Can I give you an example of one that would, for your administrative rules, it'll be very easy, where there's a record of a fire within a period of time, and the house is either completely or largely demolished. And I'm thinking of the house around the corner from where I live in Northeast Portland, which was one of the first fires I went to when I was fire commissioner years ago. I don't think that house was destroyed. The shell still stood, and it was unsafe. I would think that under those circumstances, and we have fewer fires, thank God, than ever before, but where there's been a residential fire, I would hope there's some mechanism to verify that with the fire bureau and determine that that house is not worth deconstructing.
Exactly. And so things like fire, rot, or mold that would either make it unsafe or unworthy to be deconstructed would certainly be things to be considered. And the, you know, if you look at the exemptions, there's three. One's moving a house. You don't really need to deconstruct a house if it's going to be moved. The second one are ones where BDS has determined that they're unsafe, but that doesn't necessarily mean that a building is unsafe. Those are just ones that they have gone through, usually a nuisance process, and have identified because of complaints. So we want to make sure that there are also other opportunities that folks can point out that, hey, this house is listing to one side, it's in danger of collapse, and we don't want a work crew going in there and disassembling it.
Thank you both. Thanks very much. And we have a sign up. We have some invited testimony first. We have Kelly Haynes from Work Systems, Stephen Reichard from Our United Villages and the Rebuilding Center, and Jordan from Earth Advantage. So come on up. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you.
Who'd like to start?
Sure, I'll start. I'm Kelly Haynes with Work Systems. Thank you for inviting us to talk about the deconstruction work. I can speak specifically to the workforce training and hiring plan. Work Systems worked with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and a group of stakeholders to develop a plan to ensure some of the to ensure capacity over the next year in the workforce and contracting. So, you know, Sean went over a lot of the details, but I can just say that I think we convened a really broad group of stakeholders, including labor unions. The laborers were involved because they do some trainings related to deconstruction already. A lot of the pre-apprenticeship programs were involved, so Oregon Tradeswomen came regularly, Constructing Hope and Portland Youth Builders. And then we also had a lot of the contractors involved. And to me, that's the key piece in developing a training program that's responsive to hiring needs. I, in my past, worked for Clean Energy Works, and so I sort of borrowed from that model that was pretty successful over now going on 6 years to hire weatherization workers for energy efficiency. And what we learned and what we're applying to this is to really be in close contact with the employers themselves and determine through surveying regularly what workforce needs they have, and then building and planning around those responses directly. I think if you train 30 people at once, but only 5 are needed in the next month, those people realistically go find another job because they need to feed their families. So as much as we can plan these things so that we have a skilled and capable workforce that's super responsive to the employers and when they're ready to hire and who they want to hire, whether it's a crew lead or an entry-level person, that's the best way to design it to make sure that you have the capacity when it's needed. And so that's really how we design the workforce and training program. And directly working with the pre-apprenticeship programs, because they do have 7 to 9 week programs that already pre-screen people really well, train them in construction, getting OSHA 10 and OSHA 30 certifications that will play well into getting a job in deconstruction. So really leveraging those existing resources, I think, is a smart thing. And also, you know, their participants are primarily women and people of color, so that will help to prioritize those populations getting into this. And I think, you know, Amy from Oregon Tradeswomen already is working with the Rebuilding Center quite a bit because it is a really good entry-level position for people who are just getting into the field of construction to gain a lot of hands-on experience. So that was my role in it, and I'm glad to be a part and be able to contribute. Thanks.
Thank you. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So as was mentioned, I represent Earth Advantage. I also served on the city's deconstruction advisory group. As a member of that group, I saw firsthand the diversity of perspectives that were incorporated in the care and diligence exercise to develop an ordinance that would have a meaningful impact while maintaining achievable goals. And just as much care has been taken in the development of the code language now being considered in the workforce development plan that'll build the capacity needed to ensure that the goals of the ordinance are met. Earth Advantage will play a coordinating role in the city's project manager training, which will certify the list of contractors approved to deconstruct properties subject to the ordinance that takes effect this fall. In addition to established deconstruction firms like Deconstruction Services at the Rebuilding Center and Levitt Deconstruction, we expect at least 11 additional CCB licensed contractors to complete the city's training and certification program next month, adding needed capacity to ensure that builders aren't faced with prolonged wait times to have their sites cleared. The professionals who represent the bulk of knowledge and experience in the local deconstruction and material reuse industries will be engaged in ensuring that the goals of the ordinance are met. A number of builders have already shown leadership on this issue by voluntarily deconstructing some of their projects, and many others that I've spoken to have expressed an interest in finding opportunities to divert waste from their projects. In my role as project consultant and materials broker for Earth Advantage, it's my job to connect builders, developers, and contractors with the resources that they need to efficiently and cost-effectively meet their project's waste diversion goals. And I'll continue to do that while helping them comply with this ordinance. I'll serve as a resource to help manage the flow of materials, connecting clients with destinations for their reusable materials, and helping those in search of quality reclaimed materials find what they're looking for. My role is a small part of a growing local material reuse industry, which will both support and benefit from policies like this one. And the benefits of this ordinance will be felt throughout the community. Dozens of jobs will be created, largely for people from underserved and underrepresented communities. Many local contractors will expand their operations. Local nonprofit and for-profit material resellers will have greater access to quality materials, which will largely be kept here in the community, serving local residents. And hundreds of tons of reusable material will be diverted from local waste stream, from our local waste stream each year. So I believe that the adopted ordinance is a meaningful step forward, and I appreciate your leadership on this issue.
Thanks for your help, Jordan. Thank you very much. Richard, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Once again, my name is Stephen Reichert, and I serve as the executive director of the Rebuilding Center. The Rebuilding Center deconstructs homes and occasionally commercial structures, salvaging the materials for resale in our warehouse on North Mississippi Avenue, and reinvesting our profits, such as they are, back into the community. We've been working closely with the Deconstruction Advisory Group and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to develop the training and certification program that we'll be rolling out. And indeed, I plan to take the management course myself in July, and I'm very much looking forward to that. We are also pleased with the proposed code language that's been developed by the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability in consultation with the Deconstruction Advisory Group. The historic resolution that was adopted by City Council on February 17th, mandating the deconstruction of all homes older than 100 years, is tremendously exciting for us and for the entire deconstruction industry across the United States. It was a focal point of a national conference that was held by the Building Materials Reuse Association on the East Coast in March and has been the subject of much discussion around the country. There is an intimate relationship between the deconstruction industry and the provision of meaningful work with meaningful wages and benefits to individuals who do not traditionally have access to such opportunities, including people of color, women, veterans, criminal justice-involved individuals. And we are looking forward to the opening that this ordinance creates to offer more such opportunities to individuals such as this in the fall and well into the future as we extend the mandate to newer homes and, with any luck, to commercial structures as well. At the Rebuilding Center, we believe that true sustainability refers not only to the environmental impact, but also to the impact of economic development. So truly sustainable development must offer real economic opportunity for everyone, while simultaneously protecting the environment for future generations. So we view the deconstruction ordinance through this lens and are tremendously gratified by the action of Portland City Council. And if I could just go off script for a moment, sort of address some of the issues that arose earlier. I was on the phone this morning with a contractor who has served diligently on the Deconstruction Advisory Group for the last year and a half, and he said to me that, it was with some reluctance and trepidation that he participated in this entire process over the last 15 or so months, but that he, in the end, went along and supported this because he felt that the process was fair, that there was lots of give and take, and that we reached a reasonable accommodation for everyone involved. And so I just wanted to offer that to you. And thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. Well, Steve, you and your business already have a lot of credibility on this issue, but I got to say that wrist brace takes it to a whole new level.
It's more of a metro issue. Hit one of those street tracks last week. So.
Oh.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. All right. I think that's it for invited testimony. I know there's some other folks signed up to speak, so let's call those, please.
We have six people signed up. The first three, please come on up, are Terry Parker, Shedrick Wilkins, and J. Veronica Bernier.
Come on up.
With Barbara Kerr.
All right, Cedric, you can go ahead, please. You can go ahead.
Yes. Can you go first?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you first, Terry? I didn't remember.
It doesn't
order.
Matter.
Go ahead, please. He's being gracious.
I'm going to go first?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. I just want to say briefly that when I think of deconstruction, I think about the tragic death of an actor named Steve McQueen. He was a great actor, Hollywood actor. He in World War II, he worked in an asbestos, around asbestos, and got mesothelioma, and he died painfully. It ended his career. He was like 50, and it was tragic. I think he wasn't aware at all that he was dealing with this asbestos material, which was commonly used in houses in the 1940s. And so, but what I'm saying is, when you smash up a house and there's little kids walking by in the wind, we need to take into consideration that this could harm him, and it honors Steve McQueen to kind of say that we are aware of this now, and honors his death. And it was very tragic. I liked the actor. He was pretty good. And maybe someday, if this is the first city, maybe a Los Angeles, California, where Hollywood will adopt the same deconstruction process and will honor both Portland and Steve McQueen.
Thank you. Terry, welcome.
Thank you. Terry Parker from Northeast Portland. The preservation of existing affordable single-family homes needs to be one of the city's top priorities. Way too many of Portland's quality-built, viable, and starter homes are being demolished. Most of them by using diesel smoke belching excavators that create clouds of lead paint and asbestos dust. That dust then lands on neighboring properties, including homes, yards, and schools. If a house is torn down, the sustainability and preservation tools must be found within the deconstruction toolbox. In the 1920s, Portland was in the midst of a new home building boom. These homes are of high quality construction built with old growth lumber. Another building boom took place after World War II. When one of these homes is slated for demolition, it is a crime not to preserve the reusable materials, irreplaceable lumber, and historical artifacts such as period window frames, interior moldings and trim, and other materials of character that otherwise could not be replaced. The proposed deconstruction policy only applies to approximately one-third of the homes that are demolished nearly every year. Extending and amending the deconstruction mandate to include homes built with old-growth lumber in the years from 1917 to 1930, and then to full implementation that would include all homes demolished, cannot come soon enough. These homes must not continue to be crunched up into a pile of debris only to be dumped in a landfill. Deconstruction as opposed to mechanical demolition needs to become the standard and the norm. Finally, instead of accepting delay and claptrap excuses from the development community, grasp the opportunity today to reduce lead paint dust and other hazmat issues, create new jobs, and even add more vibrancy to an already thriving reuse marketplace. There is an unmet demand of reusable product for both restoration and repurposing uses. Take the Field of Dreams approach. Implement a fast-paced track to a full implementation of the deconstruction mandate, and then watch sustainability soar to new heights. And another thing that I wanted to say, and I didn't really know how to write it, and since I have 3 minutes, is that some of the air quality monitoring stations have actually detected demolitions within this that are nearby. There's a spike in their bad air quality, and the lead paint, it was used through the 70s. So it is an important issue. I mean, we're not telling Bullseye, well, go ahead and do what you're doing. Until you install the proper equipment, we're saying, hey, we've got a problem here. We've got a problem here with demolitions, too, and creating this dust. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Barbara, welcome.
My name is Barbara Kerr. I am the United Neighborhoods for Reform representative to the Deconstruction Advisory Group. UNR is excited that the ordinance begins requiring deconstruction for houses if they must be demolished. However, the ordinance does not include a commitment to move beyond houses built prior to 1917 or that are historic. Neither does it yet address multifamily housing, accessory dwellings, accessory structures, or commercial buildings. In light of our increased awareness of the toxins in our air and the dangers of lead and asbestos, this is no longer acceptable and, in fact, highly irresponsible. Within 2 years, the cutoff needs to be moved up to 1978, the year lead was banned in consumer products. Houses built prior to 1917 are, as Sean said, one-third of our current demolitions. Requiring the next one-third by fall of 2017 would take us to 1940. From there to 1978, by fall of 2018, would reach a milestone in keeping lead out of our air, along with asbestos and other toxins. Builders, like glass manufacturers, need to be responsible for the pollution they produce. Deconstruction is an easy way for them to do it. It is the inconvenience of working deconstruction into a schedule and the possible increased cost at a small fraction of the price of a house, especially if the price is what the market will bear anyway, more important than the learning disabilities that can result for even one child from even a tiny amount of lead. Once the deconstruction industry ramps up to meet increased demand this year, they will have met the initial most difficult challenges. If later substantial problems arise, the schedule can be delayed. The impact on public health and the environment, however, cannot be delayed. To make the transition to deconstruction a success, quality standards must be set from the beginning. The training programs will be a major influence, but the code needs to set a higher standard and enforcement needs to be even stronger. The certified deconstruction contractor who is assigned to the project needs to visit the job on a daily basis if the work is being done by a crew not trained in deconstruction. The ordinance allows exemptions for buildings deemed by BPS to be unsuitable for deconstruction if, quote, more than 50% by weight of otherwise reusable materials in the structures are not suitable for reuse because they are damaged, deteriorated, hazardous, or missing, end quote. To meet the goals of the ordinance, however, the only reason not to deconstruct is potential danger to the deconstruction crew. Materials being deemed not reusable has nothing to do with their potential to pollute the neighbors if pulverized by mechanical demolition, especially if the materials are damaged or deteriorated by mold or fire. Not having enough materials has nothing to do with keeping what is there in the reuse stream and out of the landfill. Exemption based on missing materials invites further incidences of the current problem of houses being stripped of easily removed valuable parts before demolition permits are granted in order to avoid regulation. The fines are too low. Deconstruction doesn't always cost more, but on some jobs, even $10,000 can be less than the difference, which doesn't deter smashing a house. The ordinance calls for inspections as necessary. There needs to be inspections, as there are with electrical, plumbing, etc., with at least one before the job starts, so inspectors will have knowledge of materials and initial condition of the house. We are on our way, but the stakes are too high to take our time. We are asking you to set a two-year timeline to a 1978 cutoff, strengthen the enforcement code, and empower Sean and the BPS to support this vital transition. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your help. Okay, others that are signed up?
I show two more, Paul Grove and Mike Mitchoff.
Okay, come on up, please.
Mayor Hales, members of council, for the record, Paul Grove with the Portland Home Builders. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Submitted written testimony. You can certainly review at your convenience. A number of the issues that we raise in our testimony were discussed in the earlier panel. We noted three considerations moving forward around the capacity that we talked about in terms of the firms and the workforce, meeting that need by the October 31st deadline, and certainly appreciate the friendly amendment that was offered by Commissioner Fish on that front. I think it makes sense to check in advance of that date to make sure that we're progressing accordingly. And secondly, we talked about, and that also touched upon the timing considerations as well, the effective date, and if that indeed makes sense. We also talked about the cost considerations as well in the testimony, noting it could be upwards of $8,000 to $10,000 of additional project costs and what that looks like in terms of the cost of housing, ultimately being borne out in the cost of a home. I think the last thing we want to see is an unintended consequence to inadvertently raise housing prices if there are delays or other things that, accompany this on that front. One of the things, though, that we noted, and we mentioned back in February, and I want to be very clear, is really commend BPS effort on this front. Sean has been very good and very professional to work with. We've discussed a number of the items in terms of some of the potential considerations for refinement around director discretion and what that looks like in terms of if there is capacity or timing issues, working with the certified firms to look at what that exemption piece looks like. And Sean's been very, and BPS have been very good to work with. The Deconstruction Advisory Group has been very good to work with on this front. we do outline the potential consideration for a sustainable funding source around an incentive. I know that there is the grant program. At some point in time, if that is exhausted, what does that look like moving forward to help mitigate that cost? Also think for potential consideration moving forward, let's reward those firms that are engaging in a deconstruction and are building at a higher standard, a higher performance standard around energy efficiency. And is there the prospect for a rebate on that front if they exceed code standards and to lessen our residential carbon footprint, presumably built longer, better, end product at the end of the day. So those are some items outlined in the testimony. Really believe there's a great opportunity, as we noted in February, around the workforce development piece, to partner with the trades, to help the construction industry, the trades, to do this and provide a career pathway for folks that otherwise have been disenfranchised in the past. And I think we want to be at the table as part of that conversation and look to help refine the proposal as best possible before it becomes effective. There's been a lot of metaphors out there, and I'll just quote John Wooden and say, I think it's important to be quick, but don't hurry. And the more thoughtful we can be in this approach, the better off it's going to be to ensure its success. Thank you.
Paul, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
I appreciate your testimony. We've had two people testify before you that we should tighten this up to have some kind of certification process around hazardous materials in connection with the deconstruction. As you know, the Multnomah County Health Department tests children. Actually, I think we pay for it to determine whether children have elevated levels of, let's say, lead. And I'm just going off memory, but in the last 3 years, they've tested about 5,000 children. Several hundred children tested elevated levels. They then do what they call investigations. In almost, I believe, in 100% of the instances, they traced it back to either lead paint or, in some cases, lead in the toys that children's using. And a couple times, it was lead in kitchen utensils. Notably, not a single one so far lead in the water. But to the extent we've identified lead as a hazard, and we're talking about lead paint, the dust, et cetera. Do you have any thoughts about how we, as we move to a deconstruction process, we can ensure the highest level of safety with respect to lead?
I think I appreciate the question, Commissioner Fish, and hopefully I do it justice in my answer. Certainly, an issue and an item for concern for the association, the industry, and its members. And we're very active on this front in terms of our lead-based training courses and other things to get folks up to speed so that we can do the best possible work on that front to, ensure safety for our residents. So I think there is a strong role for the association to enhance that, to partner with others, these firms, to make that a more robust effort.
Question, Paul, for either you or for Mike. How far in advance would a home builder typically know they might be demolishing or deconstructing a home?
I'll defer to Mike on that.
And please, and then go ahead and give us the rest of your thoughts, too.
Okay. How far in advance? I would say immediately when you know If you're a builder and you're in the market of building homes, I think you know pretty quickly. I'll speak for myself.
Well, I guess let me clarify. I'm trying to figure out what would the normal lead time be between, hiring. If you're going to go out and hire somebody to demolish a home, is it because you decided a week ago that you're going to demolish a home is it months or what?
I would say months. Okay. I know months, if not more, in advance.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you would, hopefully that means that you would have months to find somebody to, if you needed to do deconstruction, you would have some time, not just a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, across all the trades, I would say I most of my subcontractors know well in a month, more than a month in advance that they're going to be doing the work, if not two or three.
Please, go ahead.
Okay. First, thank you for the opportunity to say a few words about the proposed mandate. My name is Mike Mitchoff. I'm a fourth-generation Portlander, local builder, remodel of affordable homes, an active member of the Residential Infill Project Stakeholder Advisory Committee. I'd like to share my experience and thoughts regarding deconstruction. To be clear, I am in support of deconstruction. In general, I have always and will continue to implement the process in my everyday business practice in some form or another. That said, I've always viewed deconstruction as a choice, part of a voluntary, bigger picture solution. I've always tried to be environmentally progressive and conduct myself and my business practices the right way, and view deconstruction as a good fit for me. Clearly, I'm one of the few that have had real-life experience in deconstructing houses. If you've done one single deconstruction, you know how time-consuming, difficult, expensive, dirty, and challenging it can be. There's no doubt that deconstruction in some form or another is a good idea. There are benefits. But in my experience, the yield and unintended consequences from full deconstruction is where I'm conflicted for a few reasons. Number one, in my experience, I would say that around 50% or more of the actual economic value created by deconstructing can be achieved in two working days via a partial deconstruction of a house, basically harvesting the cabinets, hardware, millwork, plumbing and electrical fixtures, landscaping, hardscape. Basically, it can all be efficiently and effectively moved quickly. Number two, the cost, as you guys well know. The true cost isn't just mechanical demolition versus labor hours to deconstruct. There's a lot of factors we need to consider. A simple $350,000 to $400,000 project that gets delayed a couple months, equals $3,000 to $4,000 per month to carry that project. I think we all know who will ultimately bear that expense: renters and home buyers. And how about the reclaimed material itself? Am I supposed to simply give it away as a donation? There are only a handful of companies that accept it or buy it, and oftentimes when their inventories swell, they get considerably pickier with what we give them. I love donating material, but let's be real. We donate out of the goodness of our heart, not as a business decision. Let's not kid ourselves into thinking that the cost of deconstruction can be offset by a tax deduction. Number three, the health concerns. On the surface, it seems like mechanical demolition is dirtier, less environmentally friendly. I would encourage you to go to one of these sites. Workers routinely remove their masks and expose themselves to who knows what. So my question is exposing, 5 to 8 workers, 8 hours a day for 3 weeks at a time doing a house, simply worth it? If water consumption is a concern, how about simply deconstructing on a rainy day? We have lots of those around here. You've kind of addressed some capacity concern. Number five is the net yield. I love reclaimed old growth lumber. As a matter of fact, my brother started and operates a large scale wood reclamation company here in Portland. I install it in virtually every single one of my new homes. I believe in reclaiming and reusing the old growth wood from these houses. My concerns are twofold in regard to yield. Consider the resources it takes to remove a single stud from the wall and rafters of a house, let alone all of them. And number two, what is that reclaimed stud going to be used for? I can promise you from experience that it will not likely be used in the construction of a new home. Auxiliary structures like a shed or a treehouse, high-end design paneling, or flooring at Starbucks, or an art project maybe. A new home, I just don't think so. One of my business mottos is to think it through. I really think that we need to look deeper, beyond what sounds and feels good. I would encourage you and the other people here today to think it through as well. I would encourage you, as the leaders of our community and all of the other citizens of our wonderful city, to really evaluate the entire scope of this proposal. Deconstruction is no doubt a very progressive alternative to mechanical demolition, but I fear unintended consequences. Given my hands-on experience, I support partial deconstruction and ideally the creation of some sort of incentive-based full deconstruction model. The city deconstruction grant program is a great start, but we need to do what we can to incentivize this process so more people want to participate rather than creating another costly barrier to entry that ultimately gets passed on to renters and homeowners.
I can need you to wrap up. So
Something along the lines of the SDC waiver program, 10-year tax abatement program, something along those lines. I just think we need to set this thing up for success. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Appreciate you being constructive critics and participants in this process. Thank you. Okay, anyone else wants to speak on this item? Further questions from council? This is not an emergency ordinance. It will come back. I just have some comments I want to make, and maybe there's some other questions. And I think this hearing really illustrates a couple of things. I think, one, that there is, you know, a division of opinion about how fast we should move on this. You know, again, I think this process has been very good in terms of airing those concerns and also trying to calibrate our approach. Secondly, you know, frankly, this is classic Susan Anderson, in that this woman has an ability to find the sweet spot where we move thoughtful progress at just the right pace. You know, we've got the housing industry